alcoholic. I would like to thank Kathy for asking me to speak. I met her last summer at the Mammoth Conference, and she said, I'd like you to speak in April, and that felt like 20 years from now. And here we are, it's April. And I would like to dedicate my share to my friend Andrea, who died unexpectedly yesterday at age 54. And I just want to dedicate this share to her. So I'm going to talk about my story, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. What it was like is I am from Cincinnati, Ohio, and I grew up with a dad who was a doctor and a mom was a housewife. And I was taught at a very young age that it's better to look good than to feel good. And it's pretty ironic. My dad was a psychiatrist, and he never once asked me how I felt about anything. It was about how I performed and if I won. And by the time I was 8 years old, I was playing national tennis tournaments. And I felt so much pressure to win. I felt that my whole self-worth depended on it. And I remember when I lost a tennis game, I would just go into my room and cry for hours because I didn't lose a game. I lost being a worthwhile person in my own childhood head. And I had my first drink when I was 14. And I love the way it made me feel because it turned off the voices in my head, the perfectionism saying, you're not enough, you're not good enough, you could be doing it better. Why aren't you doing it as good as that person over there? What's wrong with you? And when those voices turned off, I could be connected. And I remember my first drink was peppermint schnapps, and it was at a holiday party in my neighborhood, and they were handing them out on trays. And it was a party mixture of like adults and high school kids. And I had that shot of schnapps, and I felt like finally I could talk to people and not be in my head. And I decided in that moment that I was going to focus all my effort and energy on feeling that way as much as I could. And at that age, it was every weekend. And in ancient history, when we had answering machines, I know I'm dating myself, every weekend I would put, this was like my version of a Facebook post, I would put on my voicemail what party to go to and where to find me. And I loved it. I loved that my identity was drinking. And I branded myself before people did personal branding. Whenever I showed up at the party, I had the U2 song Party Girl like blaring out of my car. And I just loved it. I loved the culture around it. I loved getting drunk. I just loved checking out. And I remember, you know, being underage, not being able to drink. So we would always be bumming beers off the guys at the parties. And we were a bunch of sophomore girls hanging out with senior guys. And the senior girls called us the beer sluts. And I was the queen of the beer sluts. And I was kind of hated. Like, my house got egged. My yard got TP'd, toilet papered. My parents got prank calls. I was kind of, like, very hated. And I remember getting drunk, being like, you know, crying to my friend, oh my God, if they only knew the real me and how much pain I'm in and how I'm just like suffering, they would never hate me like they do. And I felt so much self-pity as a drunk. And I remember being on a cruise with my brother who I did bully, and he holds it against me to this day. He's actually an Al-Anon and I'm his qualifier. So if any of you are an Al-Anon, I'm sorry on behalf of all of us alcoholics for hurting your feelings. So I was bullying my brother for most of our childhood, and I remember like getting drunk on a cruise, and he was sober, and I was just like crying in my drink. Oh, I'm so sorry, I shouldn't have bullied you. I'm terrible, and just I was a self-pitying drunk. It was like the whole saying, "Pour me a drink." A lot of self-pity, and I was into the whole alternative music scene where I would wear all black, and I had the back of my hair shaved and dyed black, and it was so funny because this alternative music station in LA was saying, you know, instead of March Madness, it was March Sadness, and that's kind of how I lived my life, is March Sadness. I was just like milking like self-pity in a huge way, and when I wasn't in self-pity, I was trying to win, and I just continued to drink. I had really toxic relationships where people would ghost me or I would ghost them, or they would call me at 3 a.m, like cussing me out, and I would sit there listening. It was just, everything was just dramatic and very, very painful and very toxic. And my only escape was to drink. I remember I have different disorders, you know, don't be jealous, but I'm a triple threat, you know, AA, Al-Anon, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. And in the back, I've just bought a daily meditation on eating disorders, which I don't have, but I did dabble with in high school. So I remember when somebody I really liked broke up with me, like suddenly, like he ghosted me before there was a word for it. And I got so depressed that I literally could not eat. I just couldn't eat, and I just wasted away to almost nothing. And it was because I hated myself. I really hated myself. So I finally got through high school. I ended up getting into a really good college, an Ivy League college. And I got to that college, and I was like feeling very apart from, very not good enough, which is how I usually felt. But it was heightened at that college because I felt like everybody knew each other. They went to preppy East Coast boarding schools, and I was coming from a public school in Ohio. And I just felt like outside, like an outsider. So I was like, the only way for me to fit in with these people is to drink them under the table. And that's what I did. So I would go out every night. They had free beer on tap, which was an alcoholic stream. And my goal was, as I said, to worship the porcelain god, which means to throw up. So I would go out, I would drink until I threw up. And then I figured I've just thrown up, so now I can eat whatever I want. So I would walk down the halls of the dorm and people would order pizza and leave the pizza box outside in the hallway. And then I would just eat everyone's leftover pizza. Or I would get drunk, black out, and eat my roommate's care packages. And then when they asked me if I ate them, I would just like laugh and make fun of them or something. Like I didn't have a lot of remorse. And I remember when I read, I've done the fourth and fifth step many times, but in one of my first fifth steps, the sponsor was not very empathetic. And she said, so what I'm hearing is that you're like a really bad sociopath. And I'm like, I thought you were supposed to hug me and say I was just like you. So I ended up having my first serious relationship at that college. And they say in AA, we don't have a relationship, we take a hostage. And this guy was my hostage, and we were hanging out every night. And he had the nerve to want to go out with his buddies. And I was so upset that I had to act out. So I was like, what can I do? So I went to the dining hall, I had dinner. I met this couple that were potheads. And they're like, well, come hang out with us and get stoned. And I was like, all right, I have nothing better to do. Now, prior to that, you know, this was the early 90s. There was like a resurgence of Grateful Dead and like kind of hippie 60s culture. And I had decided that I was vehemently against that. I wouldn't let anyone play the Grateful Dead in my car. I didn't want to wear tie-dye. I wanted to wear all black. I was just like, oh my God, these people need to get over it. It's like 1990, not 1965. Like, they need to like realize we're in a different time. So I would make fun of potheads. I'd be like, they're just not over the 60s. So I decided to get high with these two people. And while I was getting high, the whole time I was talking about this boyfriend and what a great guy he was and how much I loved him and blah, 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 on and on and on about this boyfriend. So the next day, he calls me up and he's like, hey, what'd you do last night? And I'm like, oh my God, I smoked pot. It was the coolest experience I've ever had. I'm going to be a daily pot smoker now. And I'm going to actually design a t-shirt that says the name of our university on the front and Bong Hits 101 on the back. And smoking pot was like, I was wrong about it. It's really cool. And he said, going out with you is scary because you have no self-identity. You pick your personality based on the last movie you watch. And I was like, wow, that is a low blow, because it was true. I really had no sense of self. I mean, I based my whole life on like TV and movies because I had no idea how to act. My parents did not teach me how to act. My dad was a workaholic. My mom was a pill popper. And nobody taught me really anything. I mean, I had very few boundaries. I would be talking to my parents on a Saturday night, drinking like vodka and orange juice and laughing because they didn't even know that I was drinking. And I didn't have a sense of identity, and he was right. And it really hurt. And I said, you know what? I'm going to show this guy. So I was either going to, I actually went to the hotel to catch a shuttle to the airport. I was going to visit my friend at University of Arizona and just kind of disappear and go off the grid and make him wonder like, wow, where'd she go? She's not in her dorm. I can't get a hold of her, and like freak him out and just disappear off the campus. Or I was going to do a suicide attempt. So I decided to go for the suicide attempt because I used to be a drama addict, and my motto used to be, I have drama, therefore I exist. And I staged a very dramatic suicide attempt. I wore all black. I drew the blinds of my dorm room. I made a mixtape. Remember mixtapes? A nice combination of Pink Floyd and The Cure. And I took a bottle of Tylenol cold medicine. And I laid in the, it was like staged. I laid in a fetal position like this, and I had a bottle and two Tylenol cold medicine pills between the bottle and my mouth. So if I really did black out or pass out or get sick, you know, people would know how to fix the situation. I didn't think I was going to die. So I laid there with a sad mixtape playing, waiting for him. I knew he was going to show up and check on me, but he did not show up and check on me. Instead, it was my roommate, and she walked in. She saw this dramatic set that I had designed, and she immediately called the ambulance. The ambulance came right over to the dorm, oxygen tube in my nose, put me on a stretcher, and they took me out of the dorm room right at lunch when everybody was watching, and it was totally humiliating. And they took me to the student hospital where I was put on a 24-hour suicide watch. And the tennis coach visited me, a psychiatrist visited me, and he gave me the test, the 12 questions that are on the pamphlet in the back. I just saw it earlier, are you an alcoholic? And I passed that test with flying colors. And he said, I think you might have a problem with drinking. Would it be okay if I sent in a student who also goes to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I was like, yeah. I had nothing to do that day to drink, but drink charcoal. And this was not the trendy charcoal that they sell in California. This was like literally, it tasted like drinking a jug of chalk. And I was drinking charcoal, just sitting in bed, waiting to see who could possibly walk in from Alcoholics Anonymous. I had maybe kind of heard about it in movies, but I thought it was kind of like Weight Watchers, like from the Flintstones, where they just chase you around and like say, don't drink, don't drink. So I was curious to see who would walk in and what they would have to say. So in walks this girl, and she's a tall, blonde Southern belle from Atlanta. And she was everything that I thought I had to be accepted at that university. And she did an old school AA 12-step call. She told me her story. And I related with the feelings. And she said, when you get out of the hospital, do you want to go to an AA meeting on campus? And I was like, sure. So I walk into an AA meeting, and it's this beautiful Gothic building, and it's a candlelight meeting, and everybody's sharing authentically, and they're sharing the feelings that I always wanted to share but didn't have the courage or didn't even know I felt, because I was so out of touch with how I felt. I was constantly numbing myself. And I was like, oh my God, this is like the best feeling in the world. I didn't even know these people existed. Like, these are the people I was looking for at every bar and party, and they're all here in one room sharing. I'm in. So I was like, what do I need to do to be a part of this? And they said, get a sponsor, do 90 meetings in 90 days, get 3 commitments a week, and start working the steps. I was like, absolutely, I'm going to do exactly that. So I got meeting, I got commitments, I did my 90 and 90, I started working the steps, and boy, did I have a pink cloud. For the first time in my life, I went from being an atheist to having a connection with a power greater than myself, and it felt so good to not have to do everything by myself. I was a control freak, and having something to turn my life and my will over to that would take care of me and look out for me and run my life, I was like, this is the best feeling in the world. I felt free. And that's the whole reason why I drank. I wanted to feel freedom from the bondage of self. And I finally felt freedom when I started working the steps. So I started working the steps. I was still not over this first relationship. And I would run into him on campus, it would start again, then we would break up. I knew it wasn't a healthy relationship for me because he was a drinker and a drug user, and I was told in AA, if I want to get sober, I only have to change one thing, and that's everything. And I knew that I wouldn't want to be hanging out with somebody who did alcohol and drugs and being sober. And they told me in AA, if you hang around the barbershop long enough, you might just get a haircut. So I didn't want to hang out with the same drinkers and partiers. And it was a really lonely time in my life because the whole culture of college is to drink and get drunk. And yes, I was going to meetings and stuff, but it was just, I just felt really lonely. So I would start back up in this relationship that I knew wasn't good for me. So I finally thought the only way to truly get over this guy and to make him really miss me and realize that he effed up by not acting the way I thought he should, because I am a recovering Al-Anon too, and you can't go off script. You know, I'm the director of the show. I know how everyone should be acting, and he was not acting right. So I was going to go to Italy to show him how much he missed me, or maybe could just get over him. So I go to Italy, and I go to a couple AA meetings there, and they cross-talked. And I was like, you can't cross-talk. Like, that's against the rules in America. You can't comment on my share or interrupt me or ask me a question during my share. I was mortified. And the whole time that I was there, everyone's like, vino, vino, vino. Like, you're 20 and you're in Italy. Why aren't you drinking vino? So I eventually started drinking the wine. And I remember getting a letter when I was in Florence. And yet again, ancient history, you know, before email. So I actually got a physical letter, and one of my friends said, this woman has totally, like, seduced your boyfriend. She, like, hung out with him and smoked pot with him every day, and now they're living together. And I was like, great. And you know who that woman was? That was the woman that I had gotten stoned with. She was part of that couple. So at that point, I realized, wow, I'm going to be a great salesperson when I grow up because I sold the heck out of that guy to that woman. And now they're married with 4 kids. So I get back from Italy. I try to get into this social club. I don't get in. And I go back to AA. I thought, you know what? I was happier in AA. I was happy for the first time in my life because I found that connection to a higher power. And I wanted to feel that community again that we all feel when we are part of this thing, when we're in the middle. So I did the same thing. I got a sponsor, a different sponsor. I worked the steps again, 90 meetings in 90 days, 3 commitments a week, and I got the same beautiful spiritual pink cloud that I did a couple years before. And because of my connection to that AA community, I graduated with honors from that university. And it's so funny because Ben and I were talking about Joe's share, and he's like, your share is really different. You never went after anyone with an axe. And I was like, yeah, but I wanted to. So I graduated from that university without going after anyone with an axe. And I moved to New York City, and I fell in love with young people's AA. There were so many meetings in New York City that I could walk to. There were so many like conferences, Icky Paw, and it was a really, really happy time in my life because I was involved in AA and I was really being of service. I sponsored a bunch of people and I was having the time of my life in New York City AA. The only problem was I wasn't working. And it's kind of expensive to live in New York City, especially on the Upper West Side. And my parents were giving me a lot of crap about, you got to get a job, you got to get a job, you got to get a job. So the first job I got was, I was a manager of a French hair salon. And I took it as a compliment because they said I was the first American they ever hired. So I'm like, wow, that's cool. That means I look French. So I got kind of nervous, though, doing that job because I had to count the cashier, like count the drawer in front of an all-glass window, and it was New York City. So I quit that job, and then I got fired from a couple different restaurants, and I finally answered an ad in the newspaper, and it said, circle me. And I was really on my spiritual path. I was like, everything happens for a reason. Even if I stub my toe, like, what is the lesson? What is God teaching me? Like, I was just really into my spiritual path. And I said, circle me. Oh, my God, the universe is speaking to me. This is awesome. What does this ad say? And it said, if you want to retire in 5 years, you can join this company and you can sell products and travel all over the country. And I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. So I take a train all the way to Queens, which was like a whole different world. And it was like a group presentation. And they're telling me, all you have to do is, like, you know, sign up, start selling these products, and you can be like wealthy. And I was like, you know what? I'm 23 years old. I'm just going to give it a try. Because my dream was to move to LA and be an actress. And I was like, if I can move to LA and be an actress and not have to work, that's perfect. So I signed up. And at the beginning of doing the sales job, I was still going to meetings. I was still plugged into my AA community. But then I started traveling and I started to get away from my AA community. And I started to put making money ahead of my sobriety. And I started putting this organization and what it stood for. And this organization was all about making money, 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 money. And they would like show us videos of trainings, like with the Pink Floyd song Money. And the owner of the company would stand in front of like Ferraris and Lamborghinis and mansions. And I lost my spiritual path. I tried really hard to keep it. I was still like doing a daily 10-step and reading the daily readers like we have in the back, but I wasn't going to meetings. And like they say, the meeting makers make it. And I was not going to meetings. And I remember I was going to a meeting in Tampa, Florida. And I was at the meeting, I raised my hand, I said, I'm from out of town. And nobody came up to me and said hi after the meeting. And I was like, God, these people are total assholes. F everyone in AA, they're full of it. They say they're all about welcoming the newcomer and the out-of-towner. But again, remember the self-pity, the little mini violin, pour me, pour me, pour me a drink. So I said, you know what? These people are assholes. They didn't welcome me. They're not really like working the program and they suck. And I'm going to go to the bar and show them that I know how to find the friendly people in Tampa, Florida. So I go to an empty bar. I don't know anyone. I'm sitting at the bar alone. And some guy walks up to me and he says in a perfect British BBC accent, he's like, may I buy you a drink? And I was like, oh my God, that sounds so good. I feel like I'm in the Grey Poupon commercial. And I said, yes, of course. And with that drink, I lost my 5 years of sobriety. So that was my second relapse. I went to my first AA meeting in March of 1990, so I can't believe that was 33 years ago. Yes, I was 5 when I went to my first meeting. So I had 2 years. I drank in Italy. I put together 5 years, and then I drank again. And I knew from when I was in high school, my friends would be like, don't ever do drugs because you will, like, lose yourself. You'll be like Michelle Pfeiffer in Scarface. You'll definitely, like, you'll lose everything to coke. They're like, you don't need to do drugs. And it was really scary because when I was in junior high, I had a friend who went to a Grateful Dead show. Maybe this is why I was so against him. And he was in a blackout and he ate a whole thing of acid, like crumpled the whole thing in his mouth, and he came back retarded. So I was very scared of drugs. So I still never did drugs. I just drank. So I started to drink, do my daily 10 step, read the daily readers and do all that stuff. But like they said in one of the readings here today, that alcohol, it blocks our connection to the sunlight of the spirit. And in my opinion, they call it wine and spirits, like, because you're opening yourself to negative spirits, in my opinion. It's just my opinion. This is not the opinion of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I feel like negative things are drawn to you, and it's just major negativity when someone drinks, when I drink. So I was drinking, and I went back to my pattern of having really toxic, just bad relationships where people were treating me like shit. I was treating people like shit. And I was just making it all about the outside stuff. Where am I at on my timing? How much? 33. So I was making it all about the outside stuff. And I was trying to fill the God-sized hole in my heart with materialism, with money, property, and prestige. And it wasn't working. I was just absolutely miserable. And I was moving a lot. I would move like every 3 to 6 months, and I had a trail of dead bodies behind me, people that I sold products to that couldn't sell them, people whose hearts I broke or who broke my heart. It was just like a very nomadic lifestyle. And I knew how to go into an apartment, sign a lease, get furniture rented. I had a car full of clothes, and I was hanging out with a bunch of people in their 20s. We were all doing the same thing. We were all going from city to city in these offices. And most of us were not making any money. But we were taught, you know, dress up, wear a fancy suit, drive a fancy car, and fake it till you make it so people will sign up and sell these products with you. And I like to say that we were the best looking group of broke people I've ever met in my life. Because we would go to these offices and wear these night suits, and then we would go home, and sometimes we'd have 5 or 10 people sharing a one-bedroom apartment, and we'd be eating like peanut butter and rice cakes just to get through the night. And if I really wanted to treat myself, I would get a 1 liter of hot and sour soup at a Chinese restaurant and eat that for a couple of days. And I was just faking it till I made it. I pawned all the jewelry that my mom gave me. You can tell I like my bling. I pawned all the jewelry. I just did whatever I could to stay in that company. And what happened was the company actually, they bounced a couple of checks. I met this guy at a bar. He was a car salesman. Yep. I was living in Lexington, Kentucky, and I met a car salesman at a bar. And he convinced me to get out of that business and sell cars with him in Louisville, Kentucky. So we went to Louisville, Kentucky, and we were selling Ford cars. And Louisville gets cold in the winter. And I was like, you know what? If we're going to sell cars and stand outside all day waiting for people to drive onto the lot, why don't we sell cars in Florida? Because I don't want to sit there in the cold waiting for people to pull up on a parking lot. So we moved to Florida. And on the way down to Florida, the whole time, he has a 40 ounce of beer. And I was very nervous. And I made a joke. I was like, we're going to Florida, just you, me, and your drinking problem. And we got to Florida. We got a dog. I thought that would, like, save our relationship. And it got very abusive and very, there was no violence, but it was really, really, like, crazy abusive. And I remember I got in the dog's crate, and he pulled the crate around the apartment, and that was scary. And I said, you know what? I got to go. I got to walk the dog. And this was, like, in the middle of the night. He's like, no, the dog's fine. We have a yard. I'm like, no, I feel like he really needs to go. And I left the apartment we had in Jacksonville right on the beach, and I went to a neighboring hotel, and I called the police. And I said, you got to get I can't go back there. This guy's got a gun. He had already pointed the gun at me earlier that night. And I'm like, I can't go back there. I just, you got to get him out of there. So the police come to the house. We were living right on the beach. There was a 10-foot wall between our house and the beach, like a flood wall. He jumps it. He shatters his ankle in a million pieces. That was the last night I ever saw that guy. So I filed for domestic violence. He went to the hospital, and I packed up all his shit. I put it in the driveway. I called his parents in Kentucky. I said, you got to pick up his shit. And they begged me to drop the charges, and I did. I dropped the charges for domestic violence, but in the state of Florida, even if the woman drops the charges, the state keeps the charges. So he had to go to court. I didn't realize that he was evading DUI, and that's why he ran. And I started going to Al-Anon meetings. I was like, wow, maybe I have a problem and I'm addicted to relationships with alcoholics. And maybe, so I went to my first Al-Anon meeting in the year 2000. So what happened was I got on the internet. The internet had just started. I answered an ad on monster.com and I ended up getting a great job. And it was an internet startup company. I finally had enough money to move to California. And I moved to California with a lot of money in the bank. And I started doing extra work. And I was like, okay, you know, in any minute, I'm going to get discovered and become a movie star. And I just kept going to these extra work sets. And I was just a $50 a day non-union extra. And at this point, I had spent all my money. And I knew in LA that if I wanted to drink, I had to drink before I hit the club, because the drinks at the club were $12.50, and I didn't have that kind of money. So I would usually get drunk and then go to the bars, but this one night, I just didn't get drunk first, and I was at a bar with my brother, and I remember being at a bar, and nobody was buying me a drink. I mean, in LA, I thought, God, people are so stingy. Like, and in the Midwest, everybody wants to buy everybody a drink and share a pitcher. And it's just a different drinking culture. LA, everyone's like trying to look cool and nobody's talking to anybody but the people they came with. And like, these people, I can't get a drink out of anybody here. I can't get a drink to save my life. I don't have any money. I'm an extra making $50 a day. So I'm at a bar in Beverly Hills, and I start studying everybody's drinking pattern. How much are they drinking? How fast? And I zero in on a glass, and I notice that the person is so involved in their conversation, they haven't touched their glass of alcohol in like 10 minutes. So I'm like, excuse me, I've noticed that you haven't been drinking your drink. Is there any way I could finish it? And he's like, wow, like this is like not what you do in Beverly Hills, right? And I'm like, he's like, if you really want to drink that bad, like, yes, you can finish the drink. So I have the drink. I have a couple sips. And I'm like, ugh, it was gin. I freaking hate gin. I got so sick as a high school kid on gin. And literally, my skin curled. I got nauseous. I went to the car. And I sat in the car. I put my head on the steering wheel. And I started talking to God. And I was like, I just can't do this. Like, they say a head full of AA and a belly full of booze is a terrible combination. And I just felt disconnected, disconnected from God, disconnected from goodness and positivity and everything that I had felt when I was in AA. I felt unwanted, unloved, and alone, as they say in Al-Anon. And I wait for my brother to come out of the bar, and I'm just not happy camper. And the next day I go with a friend to Palm Springs. Now this was August. Being that it was my first summer in California, I didn't know that Palm Springs is not a good destination in August. So we go to Palm Springs and we go have breakfast at a diner. And in the bathroom of the diner, I'm just like in the toilet, just endlessly throwing up. I could not stop. Then we go back to the condo where we were staying. It's actually my brother's condo. I can't stop throwing up. So I call my brother and I'm like, I feel so sick. I'm staying at your condo in Palm Springs, but I don't know what to do. I'm so sick. And he calls his friend Brad. And I hadn't seen Brad since I was in high school. And he is literally like an angel in my life. He's probably like on his deathbed right now because he's in his 90s. I think he's still hanging in by a thread, but I will always love him because I really feel like he was an angel that day. He drove me to the hospital. I was with another young girl who we didn't know to go to the hospital. He drove us to the hospital. He was just an, I just will always love him. And I spend the day in the hospital. I'm hooked up to IV and oxygen and all the stuff. And I get out of the hospital later that night, and I say to the doctor, hey, doc, what should I do? I felt like shit the last 24 hours. You know, what's wrong with me? And he's like, you're really dehydrated, and you probably shouldn't drink for a while. And I'm like, okay. So I go back to Los Angeles. I go back to what I thought was my weekly Al-Anon meeting, but it was an AA meeting. And the woman who shared said that she had 17 years of sobriety. She went out, she came back, and she had 1 year of sobriety, and she was taking a cake that day. And I was thinking, wow, if she could have 17 years and have the humility to come back as a newcomer, maybe I could have the humility to come back after my 5 years. But I still wasn't convinced. And I talked to the women after the meeting, told them my story, and they're like, what does God have to do? Take a big book out of the sky and hit you in the face? And I was like, yes, that's actually what he has to do, because I loved Al-Anon because I could work the steps and drink. So I was not convinced. How much time do I have? 23 left? Okay. So that night, I go out on a date with a guy, first date, and he's like, do you drink? And I was like, I'm kind of thinking about quitting drinking. How about you? Do you drink? And he's like, I got out of rehab yesterday. And I looked up at the sky, and I was like, all right, God, you threw a big book at me. And I was like, caught the big book. And I was like, let's just go to a meeting. So we go to a meeting, and it was the same feeling as I had that night at that college meeting. It felt like coming home. So if you're new, if you're a newcomer, if you're coming back, welcome home. I'm glad it's come to this. I'm glad that your will didn't work out there in the big bad world, and that you get to come here. And I think of this as like a lifeboat, and you know, the real world is like being out there swimming with sharks, and you're on the lifeboat now. So I came back to the lifeboat, and I felt the excitement of a big AA meeting, just like the meeting here tonight. People are talking and laughing, and there's just an excitement in the air, positivity. And I was like, this is it. These are my peeps. I love this program. I'm back. And that was August 3rd, 2003. And one day at a time, I've been back ever since. So I have 19 and a half years. Thank you. And I did the same thing as I did the other two times I got sober. I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. I did 90 meetings in 90 days. I got three commitments, and my life started to change. And I started to reconnect with my higher power, feel the positivity, feel the surrender of, oh my God, I don't have to do it all myself. Feel the hope and faith that we read about today in Principle 2, which is the principle behind step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I came to believe that I could be restored to sanity yet again. And a lot of stuff has happened since I got sober. One of the first people that I was dating while I was sober, he called me up and he said, I gotta go, I gotta break up with you. And I'm like, why? And he's like, because I'm going to jail. And I'm like, why? And he's like, because I vandalized my ex-girlfriend's car. And I was like, well, why would you do that? And he said, because another guy gave it to her. And I was like, okay. So I still need to go to Al-Anon. So I kept going to Al-Anon. I kept going to AA. And my life looked the same on the outside. It's so funny because I had a bottom that was more of a spiritual, emotional bottom. Like when I got sober the last time in 2003, I still had the same job, lived in the same condo, drove the same car, but it was an inside bottom. I felt so hopeless and just lonely and just, oh my God, like, what is the point of life? Just hopeless. And when I got sober, I didn't feel that way anymore. I started to find friends, and I just love the fellowship. I love the community of AA. It's such a magical community. And I continued to have a really hard time. I was pretty good at making money because, like I said, I was good at sales. But I would have really painful relationships and really painful breakups. But I kept going to AA. I kept going to Al-Anon. I just kept sharing about it. I fell in love with having a dog. Like, I really think that staying sober, prayer, meditation, having a dog has been the joy of my life. And I had a yellow lab that moved from Florida to LA with me. And he was there while I was getting sober. And he was a big part of my sobriety. And when I lost that, I would think, oh my God, when I lose this dog, I'm going to drink. I don't know how I'm going to deal with the pain. I stayed sober through losing that dog. And then I got another dog, and he died last fall, and I still grieve him, but I stayed sober. So I learned that life is going to happen. You're going to lose things. You're going to lose friends. You're going to lose relationships. You're going to lose family members. I mean, with all the craziness of the last few years, I'm sure we've all lost people. And we just get to not drink or use no matter what. So I just became a member of the No Matter What Club. And I just decided that I'm just not going to pick up the first drink. You know, one drink is too many and 1,000 isn't enough. And I can just not pick up the first drink no matter what. So life continued to happen. I got engaged to someone that I met at an AA event. And I moved from West LA to the Valley, so you know it's love if you're from LA, if you move to the Valley for someone. And it was pretty funny because actually we lived in Christian Slater's childhood home, which was kind of cool because I used to think that it was my destiny to marry Christian Slater, but instead I got engaged to someone who, you know, and we lived in his childhood home. The problem was we got our first electric bill, and it was summer in the Valley, and it was $1,500. And I got pissed that he didn't want to pay his half because he had three kids and I was one person. And we started to fight a lot about money. And I still went through planning a wedding. The bridesmaids had their dresses. We booked a yacht to get married on in the marina. Me and his three kids did, you know, handmade like an assembly line of wedding invitations together as a family. And I was at the post office box, at the mailbox in front of the post office in the Valley. And I was like, no, like I can't sign up for a life of this. It's just too much fighting. His ex-wife would call us every morning at 7 to talk to the kids. He was too enmeshed with his ex-wife. Like, I was like, no. And for the first time, I had some self-esteem in my love life, and I broke off that engagement, and it's still one of the hardest things I've done in my sobriety because I felt like everything was planned and there were so many other people involved. And I broke off that engagement. I moved back to West LA. Then I chose another very inappropriate person who was actually drinking. And I was doing what I decided not to do in college. I was going to all the clubs and hanging out at, you know, Hollywood clubs, like, so 7 years sober. And he even, like, said, I don't believe you're really an alcoholic. And he put a beer can, like, this close to my mouth, and I wouldn't drink it. And I retained my sobriety, and I still married this guy. And I knew that he was a drinker. He did get sober to save our relationship, but it just didn't work out because sober doesn't mean sane. And 3 years into the marriage, I filed for divorce. And exactly at the same time as the divorce proceedings started, my dad started dying. And I was going back and forth. How much? How many minutes left? Okay. I was going back and forth from Los Angeles to Cincinnati, Ohio, watching my dad, who was always this very strong, vibrant alpha male, like decay in a nursing home. And he had this slow, painful decline. And it was just painful. Like, that was so freaking hard, watching him decline like that and just watching everybody in the nursing home being so, like, incoherent. And but I showed up for my dad, you know. I didn't want to, and I showed up. And looking back on it, I probably could have been more present. I'm like, I was on my phone a little too much, and that's, like, my current addiction. I'm sure you guys can relate, is being on your phone is, like, everybody's addiction, sober or not. I wasn't as present as I wish I could have been, but I showed up for him, and we had some great conversations. And the marriage, this guy would not move out. He was just not signing paperwork. It was like, it was a fight. I was paying for his lawyer, my lawyer. I was supporting him because he wasn't working. And it was really scary financially, but I stayed sober. And it's like, fear of financial insecurity will leave us. You know, I was very financially insecure, but I just kept showing up. I kept sharing about it at meetings. I got support from the people of AA. And it all happened within 72 hours. My dad was buried on a Wednesday, and my divorce was finalized on a Friday. And guess where I was that Friday night? I was sharing at a meeting. And it felt so good to know that no matter what happens, I have the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous to dive into, and that they were going to carry me through anything. And I got through that very sad period where I had lost my dad, lost my marriage. And I really thought I'd be alone again, alone forever, and I didn't care. I was like, I would rather be alone and sober and just have positive, happy, high-vibe people, positive, happy, high-vibe dogs, like, just be around positive people without dealing with drama and negativity and criticism. And I really had a deep surrender of my love life, and that's when I joined Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. And they said, you have to go 90 days no contact. Like, you can't talk to the opposite sex, like, for more than 2 seconds. Like, hi, how are you? Bye, okay. Like, literally, like, nothing. So I went to a backyard party thrown by the owner of my gym, and I was meeting people but not talking very long to guys. And I met Ben, who's here with me tonight. And I had a friend that was there with me, and she is a very competitive friend. I don't know, ladies, if you've ever had a friend like that who, like, wants everything that you have. And the summer before, I had, like, a relationship that was, like, kind of just an affair, and she was flirting with him in front of me. They were both getting drunk and flirting, and I'm like, oh, my God. Like, that's when I wish I would have had Joe's axe. But I still stayed friends with her. So the next summer, we're both at this party in Santa Monica. We start talking. Ben saunters up to us. She's like, I'm cold. And he's like, I got to pick up my son. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, there they go. They're hooking up. And I was like, don't worry about it, Rebecca. You're supposed to be doing your 90-day detox. You're not supposed to be thinking about sex and love, talking about it, talking to the opposite sex. Like, focus on your new program. So I just put it out of my mind. And the next weekend, he shows up at a book launch party because I had written a book, and he bought a book, and he said, hey, I'd like you to sign the book on a dinner date. And I was like, what? I couldn't believe it. And I asked my SLA sponsor, hey, I know it's only been 6 weeks, but can I go on a date? And she's like, yeah, go ahead. So I go on this date, and we've been together ever since. And he is the first person that I've ever allowed in my life that treats me nicely, kindly, that's consistent. I used to think that love was like throwing furniture at each other, yelling, like Sid and Nancy kind of love. Like, you know, if there's no drama, makeup, breakup, fighting, then that's not love. There's no passion. And if it's like easy, breezy, smooth, peaceful, then that's something else. But this is a very beautiful, loving relationship. We've been together 5 years. We still haven't had a fight, which is like, what? That's like a miracle in my life and with my past. And we got married on 12, we got engaged on 12/20/20, and then we got married on 12/21/21. So I like alignment a lot. And we got married on the beach in Malibu. And my life today is very, very full. I go to AA, I sponsor people, I've launched a couple businesses, we travel a lot, and I don't want to drink. I don't want to drink. When my dog died last fall, I didn't think about drinking. And I want to feel. Like, I don't want to check out. I don't want to be on psychoactive drugs. Like, no offense at all. If somebody here is on them, like, that's between you and your physician, and everybody's blood chemistry is different. But for me personally, I don't want to be even all the time. Like, I want to feel the joy and the bliss of being human, and I want to feel the pain and the loss and the sorrow and the grief of being human. I feel like we're only here once, and I want the biggest bang for my buck, and I don't want to check out anymore. Like, I want to be present. I want to be connected. I want to really love people. And before, I couldn't love anyone because I didn't love myself. I couldn't allow someone to be nice to me because in my own inner dialogue, I was constantly beating myself up, constantly being a perfectionist, using the words I woulda, coulda, shoulda, beating myself up. Why don't you have this? Why don't you have that? Why do they have what you should have? And on and on and on and on and on. And I'm learning. I'm still not perfect. Believe me, I'm striving for imperfection. But I am learning one day at a time, the more love and compassion and the easier I go on myself and the easier I talk to my, just treat myself, the kinder I am to myself, the easier I'm going to be on other people. And I allow people like Ben in my life. And, you know, one of the heartbreaks of my life right now is that my brother, for 4 months, he requested that I don't talk to him at all. And it's heartbreaking that my own brother doesn't even want to talk to me. And I know that he's seeing me through the lens of who I was in my drinking and who I was in my early sobriety, where I was irritable, restless, and discontent. I was quick-tempered and angry and not always nice to him. And I was a bully. But for the past few years, I know in my heart of hearts that my intention in every conversation and every share and every meeting is to be loving. And my higher power is love. God is love. And when I don't know what to do, I ask myself, what would God do? How would God see this person? How would love see this person? How would love respond? And to me, God is not some, you know, Zeus on a throne in the sky with a staff and a long white beard. It's just love. We've all felt love before. And we all know what it feels like to love. And I'm not talking about romantic love. I'm talking about pure love, agape love, which means the highest kind of love. So I know my intention in every conversation is to be loving. Do I screw up sometimes? Of course I do. But I don't beat myself up. Like I said, I'm striving for imperfection. I'm not a mistake if I make a mistake. And I want to be a force for good in the world. I want to be present. I want to be connected. I love the first 3 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous because it's a way of living for me. The first step is I can't. I'm powerless over my drinking, over my codependency, my sex and love addiction, my control issues. I'm powerless over every person, place, thing, and situation, and every word, feeling, thought, action. So step one is I can't. Step two, what I'm talking about tonight is he can, meaning faith. There is a power greater than myself. If you don't have a higher power, all you have to know is 2 things. Number one, there is one. Number two, it's not you. So when I tell someone I'm working with who doesn't have a higher power, I'm like, what is, you know, the force that's pulling the tide of the ocean in and out? What's making the sun rise every day? What's making the blades of grass grow every day? What is making the moon have its cycles? That's a power greater than ourselves. So having a higher power is he can. And third, which can be the most challenging, is, and I think I'll let him, surrender. And I remember I go to a lot of meetings on this app called Clubhouse. And it's pretty cool because you can just open an app and like find a meeting 24/7. And this woman, she was sharing, well, acceptance and surrender are the same thing. And I was like, they're really not, because acceptance is if you live in an apartment full of furniture, you're saying, I accept that this is going to be my furniture the rest of my life. This is it. I'm never going to get new furniture. I just have to accept that this is my furniture and just be good with it, Where surrender is like, God, just take all the furniture. Like, I have no idea what my next furniture is going to look like. Just take it all. I don't want it anymore. It's not working for me. This is old furniture. Just take it. And every day, sometimes many times a day, on more difficult days, I surrender my life and my will to my higher power, because I like to make up stories about people. And I like to have opinions. You know, as alcoholics, we're very opinionated. And I surrender my story. I surrender my opinion. And I just don't know. I don't know. I just have faith that things are going to work out better than I can imagine. And I like affirmations like that. Like, I believe that things are working out better than I can imagine. All things are working together for my highest good. I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. And I really believe that there's a flow of life, and that there's an energy. And life is like a river. And when I'm in my alcoholism and I'm in my ego, I'm fighting. You know, alcoholics, when we're in our disease, we're fighters. We like to fight. We like to make things hard. And when I'm in my alcoholism, I'm going upstream, and I'm fighting, and everything's hard, and I'm in resistance, and I'm complaining, and I'm criticizing, and everything's just like, like fight. And then when I'm in my solution, when I'm in my recovery, I'm going downstream, and I'm in a canoe, and I'm just like letting the current of life take me. And I'm having faith that I can just sit back in a canoe, and I can drink my bottle of water, and I can just like look at the river and look at the flowers and look at the trees and have faith that the canoe and the flow of life is taking me somewhere that I don't know, but I have faith that it's better than I can even imagine. And I think that faith is believing in the unseen, but I do believe that God didn't bring us this far to drop us on our head. And I think we've all been in situations that we thought were life or death, and we didn't know how we were gonna get out and how it was gonna work, but it ended up working out. So I think that when I look at my past and I see how God was working for me in my life, that things are really working out for me. And I remember I had one of my dogs, and I was in going to a class reunion in Michigan, and I had left my dog with someone that I didn't know, but she was recommended, so I trusted her, and she ended up being 5150, if you don't know what that means, like taken to the psych ward because she was drunk. So she left my dog alone, and I would have never known that happened, but somebody that I didn't even know somehow, some way, got my number, and she said, look, the dog sitter that your dog is with, she was taken to the psych ward, and your dog is alone in an apartment, and I'm going to figure out how to get him out. Where can I take him to? So I started calling all my friends and saying, you know, when can you go to this person's apartment and take my dog, and where can you take him? And I was like making all these calls behind the scenes. Now I think of it as that dog was kind of like us. Like he's locked in an apartment. Nobody's there. He doesn't know. Like I'm behind the scenes making all these calls, arranging for him to get picked up, helping him get to safety. And I kind of think of that as my higher power. Like, I don't know all the unseen forces and all the things that are happening that are for my highest good. I just have faith that they're happening. And I believe that my higher power loves me even more than I've loved my dogs, which is like a crazy amount. And I believe that my higher power wants my highest good, whatever that looks like. How much time? Okay. So, everybody, I appreciate you listening. Thanks again, Kathy, for asking me to share. And nice to be here. Thank you. That's my share.